Good morning, dining travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're looking again at more products today.
Yeah, if you thought we had some wacky ones last week, wait till you get to this week.
Yeah, now the first one, I don't know when we've had more fun with a product.
Yeah, I put this guy first. I put him first on purpose because he's just one of the most eccentric guests I think we've ever had. Imagine that the source of his product is somewhere in the Apollo space mission, but it's all about Virginia peanuts. So.
Pazoot. I love the name. I love the whole thing.
And so let's hear from Beau, who's going to describe the whole adventure of Pazoots for us.
I guess that we get quite a lot of products to sample, and some really stand out. And I went crazy over something called Pazoots Flavor Infused Peanuts. And so we now are going to be talking.
Okay.
So we're going to be talking to Beau Perry, who is the. Are you the CEO, owner
yes,
of the
CEO.
Company, which is sometimes called Mad Scientist Nuts, which is part of the company history. And I think, first of all, let's just talk about the company history, because that was what tripped me up. I wasn't sure about how the company got started. Bo, run us through the history of this company.
Sure. In the early 80s, I had a company in Virginia. I lived in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And a woman worked for me for 10 years. And she was a heck of a worker. We became friends. I sold the company in 1990, and she did not want to move with the company. She wanted to stay in Virginia. So she stayed in Virginia and went to work for the Ford Motor Company on the assembly line making F-150 pickup trucks.
Oh, my God.
The number one pickup truck in America.
Uh-huh. Right.
On the assembly line making the F-150 pickup trucks, she met a rocket scientist that used to work at NASA who was laid off when the space shuttle program winded down.
Oh, dear.
So together they were working on the assembly line making the F-150 pickup truck. And he was a rocket scientist that deal with pressure. And he loved peanuts, and Sherry was a cook. Together they developed the formula and how to pressurize peanuts so that you could infuse the flavor in them.
Wow.
So for like 12, 14 years, they made infused peanuts and sold them to all the employees at the Ford Motor Company.
Uh-huh.
And they became known as the peanut people at Ford. They work on the assembly line and sell peanuts by the pound to all the employees.
Wow.
Well, as you know, as life has it, the Ford Motor Company, being that this was the most profitable Ford plant in the country, they moved it to Mexico.
Oh.
Of course, you got to do that, right?
Of course, they can make more money. So they closed the plant. Our rocket scientist retired, and he gave all the information and the patent to Sherry. Sherry's my partner, Sherry Pennington. She lives in Portsmouth, Virginia.
Okay.
And she didn't know what to do because she didn't have 2,000 people to sell her peanuts to. So she remembered me and called me up and said, "Can you help me start a company?"
Now, in the meantime, Bo, what were you doing?
just a couple of years ago, I was helping to run a nonprofit agency for the pearl industry in Providence, Rhode Island. And I flew down to Virginia, and I thought, I tasted the peanuts with Sherry, and I said, "Sherry, you really have something here.
Oh, yes.
I think we can start a company. I'll make an outline of what we have to do. I'll go start raising money," and I did. And Sherry and I put the company together. Sherry's in charge of all production, and I'm in charge of everything else.
Now, how long have you been set up as a company with the Pazoots?
Well, we started selling in September of 2016.
Of which new, yeah.
That's amazing.
We're brand new.
Now, nobody had ever figured out how to do this before, Bo?
Well, there are three other companies, and they're all multinational companies.
Okay, all right.
That have a patent on infused peanuts. But according to the patents that I've read, it's not quite similar to ours. But ours is, the reason why they're not doing it is it takes 30 hours to infuse the peanuts. And no big multinational company wants to make a product that takes 30 hours. They want to do it in about 20 minutes.
Now, let's give our listeners an idea of what these infusions are, because there's some really interesting ones.
Oh, the flavors, you mean?
Yes, yes.
Yes. Okay, yeah. Our popular flavor is Baja Taco.
Yes.
Which, if you think you're eating a taco when you eat it, and it pairs very well with a beer. But the next popular one is New York Dill Pickle.
That's
okay,
my favorite.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then we have Bay Spice, which is like eating gumbo. Blazing Buffalo, which is like having a steaming plate of juicy wings packed into every nut,
yeah,
if you don't need a napkin. Habanero is our hottest peanut. Jalapeno is just a nice spicy nut. Then we have sea salt, which is just plain sea salt.
It's very good.
And it's half the salt of a regular salted peanut, but we found out that people didn't like to know that, so we didn't put it on the package, except on the ingredients label. And then we have salt, sea salt and pepper, which is the king and queen of the dinner table.
Yes.
And then we have salt and vinegar, which...
Yeah, I like that, too.
Yeah, salt and vinegar is it's very, very sweet and spicy.
Now, the other neat thing about it is the ones that have salt on them, they're not like salted peanuts. I mean, I always think there's a problem with salted peanuts because when you open the package and you start eating them, you get salt all over your hands. In this case, you have all the flavor, but you have the convenience of the fact that your hands stay clean while you're munching away.
Absolutely. There's no powder. There's no coatings. Everything we do is put right inside the peanut. Magically.
Now, where are these?
We're not going to ask you how you do that because that's a secret. But trust me, listeners, that flavor's in there. I don't know how they get it in there, but it's in there.
And and where do you make these nuts? Where do you process them?
We have a facility in Portsmouth, Virginia.
Okay.
And this is where your partner lives.
Yes. In Portsmouth, and we do everything in the facility. We process the nuts, we bake the nuts, and package them all in one building.
And, like, who did you target as your ideal customer with these?
Well, we kind of did a little homework, and we found out who ate peanuts.
Yeah.
Most people.
Most people.
It was easy. Most people.
But
in fact,
it's retail you're talking about then.
Right, yeah, we do it retail, we do it on the internet, and it's starting to work, because people are beginning to find out that it's a better tasting peanut.
Oh, it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Now, you have, it's interestingly enough, you have two sizes.
Yeah,
One is really quite small, and then the other will keep you in peanuts for 45 minutes at least.
Thank you. Yes, it is. We call the small one the small nibble.
Okay, all right.
We made it the perfect size for a protein snack. It's 10 grams of protein and 1.4 ounce of peanuts and very little fat and no sugars.
Now,
it's great if you're working out.
Did you crack the lunchbox market yet for kids?
We're working on it.
Well, there you go.
Unfortunately, with peanuts, peanuts are a little tough to take into schools.
Because of the peanut allergies, yeah.
Yes. But they're wonderful.
Juice.
They're very big in bars.
Bars and gyms would be another one, I would think. I don't know.
Yes.
As people eat anything. I mean, we get so much stuff shipped to us. I just, if we don't want it, I just take it to my gym and everybody eats. They're all so healthy here. You have this advertising marketing campaign that's quite off the wall. You have, in addition to your Pazoots peanuts label, you have Mad Scientist Nuts. Does that, and Dr. Alfred P. Pazoots, which you made up, right?
Well, we'd like to say that he's not exactly made up. He's just he's everything of our thoughts. He's how we would want to be if we could be somebody. We would want to be Alfred.
Well, it threw me for a loop when I went on your website and got Dr. Alfred Pazoots' biography.
Yes, he's quite learned, and he's a traveler. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's all made-up stuff, but it's, as I said, I found it a little confusing, but that's why.
Well, we don't call it made-up. We call it an embellishment of history.
Yeah. Now, you sell right off your site.
Yes, we have a website, www.pazoots.com.
Oh, okay. Yes. And it's spelled P-I-Z-O-O-T-Z.
Yes.
Right. And the other thing that had me confused is your email address. Something I read said that you had something to do with donations to multiple sclerosis.
Yes, we do. We give a portion of every sale goes to the MS Society of America, so that hopefully very soon MS will be wiped out in the world.
Really?
Oh, we hope so. We sure hope so.
Yes.
That would be wonderful,
we do
huh?
Too.
Was this a
yes.
private cause of yours?
Yes, my daughter came down with MS a few years ago.
Oh, shoot.
And I'll tell you, but the people, the doctors, everybody that we've dealt with has been very good, very supportive, and they're coming up with new treatments, and hopefully she's going to be able to lead a normal life.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, I heard an interview with Bill Gates the other day. Now, was he saying something about the Gates Foundation has an interest in MS and trying to fight it?
I think
it? So. I yes. thought so. That's is a good connection to have. I mean, I don't know if you heard his interview, but he and his wife cottoned on to polio as a disease they could attack. They're working on malaria as well.
Yeah, they can wipe them out.
But here was the amazing thing. Do you know how many confirmed cases there were of polio in the United States last year?
No.
Zero.
14.
Fourteen. That's great.
So imagine those numbers with MS. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, wow. It would be very wonderful.
And that's what he was saying. He said we can do that too.
Yeah.
All we need is more of his money and to go along with more of yours.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I hope this project really takes off because it's so good. And congratulations on pulling the business side of it all together.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
What's next, Bo?
Next, I want to sell Pazoots all over the world.
Okay.
That's our goal, is to get them all over the world and get people eating them and enjoying them, and we'll be happy. And then hopefully everything we do will lead to a better world.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
It's really an inspiring story.
It is.
I'm sure you thought of this already, but I can imagine that one of your targets is probably Amazon.com because they sell just about everything.
Well,
yes, and they do. They have Pazoots listed. We're on Amazon.
There you go. Great.
Yes, you are. In fact, that's where I got your email address.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, listen, have a fabulous day. I can't imagine what you'll come up with next. But when you come up with another totally mad idea, be sure to let us know.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bo. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, so he was wacky, right?
Oh, it's such a good product. I
mean, yeah.
I can't stop eating them, to tell you the truth.
We're loving them and even sharing a few. We gave some to our friend Jim the other day, and he was thrilled too. Anyway, it's time to take a break, and then we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up is not a new product. It's actually something we don't usually get to talk about. It's a revival of a once very popular. In fact, I grew up with Isley's ice cream, and I'm thrilled that they're bringing it back as a brand.
And you grew up with Isley's chopped ham too.
Yeah, well, that was not my favorite
thing. That was not your favorite thing, but the ice cream is still, and the building that housed this Isley's ice cream product.
It's still called the Isley's building,
but it's a fine marble veneer building, and everybody calls it the old Isley's building because they don't want to call it the UPMC office building. Anyway, we're glad that
Jim Conroy
is bringing this back, and you should be glad too if ever you're in this neighborhood. Wouldn't surprise me if he goes nationwide with it anyway.
Right. There's a reason why a particular very, very prominent building in Pittsburgh is called the Isley's Building, because that's what it was for, we don't know how many years, do we, Jim Conroy?
No. Isley's had 400 locations from central Pennsylvania to western Ohio throughout the panhandle of West Virginia. There's a lot of buildings out there that people are restoring. But the most iconic building, I believe, that's still there is the famous Boulevard store.
Right.
Where they made ice cream for the Pittsburgh region.
Yeah, I mean, we would go there. Our parents would take us when we were little. And you've met all your neighbors. Everybody was there.
Right. My dad lived in what they called Soho back in the day, which was South Oakland. And he lived relatively close to the to that plant.
Right.
No, I wasn't anywhere near there.
No. Peter grew up in the UK.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah.
I was close to ice cream, but not Isley's ice cream.
Yes, welcome to the Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh way.
Yeah, now, Conroy Foods, let's talk about that, Jim, to get some perspective on why this is such a great fit. Because, first of all, you're in the deli and condiment business, right?
Correct. We started a family business way 1986. My brother and I had a restaurant in Blonox called Bino's Pizza and Suds, and we sold a lot of sandwiches, of course, and we had a submarine dressing that our customers loved, and one thing led to another. We presented it to Giant Eagle back then, and they loved it, and we visited all the deli managers throughout the tri-state area, and they eventually brought it in. We grew this business into over 20, 25 different sandwich condiments, sell it almost in every deli in America, Publix, Walmart, Giant Eagle, all from East Coast to West Coast. And when we had the opportunity to, when Isley's presented itself, we thought, what a great fit to be in the, you know, be in the deli with an iconic brand, and it kind of
explain that side of it. It's not the ice cream side; it's the deli side. Which
the delis. I mean, Isley's is famous for their chip chopped ham. Chip chopped ham.
Yep.
Thinly as possible sliced, and you either use the barbecue sauce or you have it on a natural, you know, by itself with on. I'll say tantok bread.
back in the day. But, yes, so we thought it was a great, had a lot of synergy with our deli condiments by the famous iconic Isley's Chip Chopped Ham.
Now,
and
Jim,
one
Jim,
thing led to another.
That business still existed then?
Yes, yes. We actually owned that part of the business also.
So the ice cream went out of business, but the Chip Chopped Ham, that stayed in business, and that's what you bought.
Right.
And then you thought, well, my God, we can't just stop there, right?
Well,
no,
well, we bought when we bought the company, the recipes came with, the ham recipes came with it. The ice cream, we discovered the ice cream recipes, and we did a little bit of research on it. They love to have a super premium ice cream. So my wife and I had a little epiphany, so to speak. We're looking at the recipes thinking, wow, what do we do with these? Knowing that it would be very involved to start the ice cream over again. We thought about it for a while, and we decided to explore it, and we thought it was an obligation to do it, and we did it.
Well, now, the Isley's ice cream was also way ahead of its time. If you think back then, back in the day, it was, and this is what we all want now, all natural, no artificial flavors, real cream.
Right.
I mean, they were really far ahead of their times, right?
Well, things have changed. You know, some of the formulas were not all natural, or some of them had some artificial flavorings. They did very good at marketing their products. What they did have in common, what we have in common, along with the true ingredients, we have a 14% butterfat with an 85% overrun. It is a high quality. To be called ice cream, have to be at least 12%, I believe, or 10%. We try to stay as true to the recipes as possible. Things change, ingredients change over, processing methods change over the years, but we knew we needed to stay true to the high butterfat content. And overrun means there's less air in the product. The more overrun, the less air in the product, the better, the thicker, the denser the product is, similar to Ben & Jerry's or Haagen-Dazs.
I see. That's the comparable.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it came to you, Isley's went out of business, or retired, actually.
Right.
And sold it to somebody. Now, I'm trying to remember who that was.
The Daly family.
Oh, the Daly family.
Right. The Klondike bar got sold to the Unilever folks.
Right.
I was going to ask you about the Klondike.
We don't have any claims on the
market. But the the ice cream certainly has.
Right.
And now it's back.
It's interesting. Hold on just a second. This is something you may not know, sweetheart, since you didn't grow up where I did. But chocolate ice cream sandwiches were big in England when I was a child.
Right, right.
So it's not surprising, I guess, that Unilever, which is a London and actually Dutch based huge food company, now the subject of a takeover attempt from Kraft Heinz. Just
right.
Interestingly enough, should have been in the ice cream sandwich business.
They were way ahead of their time. The ice cream bar sandwich, actually, it's more of a bar. They didn't put it between two pieces of cake,
right,
so to speak. But this was a hand dipped square ice cream that they would hand dip.
And you could get it smooth or with the little chunky stuff,
yes,
right?
Yes, they put their Rice Krispie pieces on it. I assume they're Rice Krispie pieces. I'm not sure about that. But they were the first company to take a novelty bar on a national level. So the book, Brian Butko wrote a great book, and we use it for reference, Klondike's Chipped Ham and Skyscraper Cones. Brian works for the Heinz History Center here in Pittsburgh. He wrote a fascinating book about the Isley story.
Oh, I never even saw it.
Yeah, for all your listeners, that would be a great reference.
Yeah, tell us again.
The name of the book is called Klondike's Chipped Ham and Skyscraper Cones.
Right. And the guy, the author is?
Brian Butko.
Butko.
He wrote the book.
Okay.
And then another good reference for Isley's, Rick Seebeck.
Oh, yes.
He wrote a great, he had a great documentary of things that aren't there anymore.
Yeah, I know,
he had done an Isley's feature, And both of those can be linked. They're, if they go to the Isley's website, there's links on our website for those two, one publication, the other one, it shows the videos of the old Isley stores.
Well, now, what are you up to now? You're reintroducing the ice cream. Is that the deal? Okay.
Well, I was going to ask website is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What is the website that they can access this information?
It's isleys.com.
And that's isleys.com.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Anyhow, there are people who, I think nostalgia, of course, plays a big role in all of this.
Right.
The people who have their favorites that they recall from when they were children. And I told you when we first picked up the phone, I am a rainbow skyscraper cone person.
You're in good company because since Brian Butko and Rick Sivek posted it to their Facebook pages and we introduced the product, we've been inundated with two flavors. We did our homework on what were the most popular flavors, and we had the White House Cherry, which is a rich vanilla base with plump maraschino cherries, and the Maricopa, which is another vanilla-based product with streams of
butterscotch in it. Yeah, I remember that one, too.
Right, so those are the two we kind of, and then we have the mint chocolate chip. We have a chocolate chip cookie dough.
That was another one. The cookie dough was a big one.
Yeah, we have that. But we're considering two more, one being the rainbow and the other one toasted almond fudge. We've received a lot of requests for those two flavor profiles.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming. It's so exciting.
Yes, we never realized how people have been so receptive towards the Isleys.
Now you have by the pint, right?
We sell it by the quart.
By the quart.
And we did our homework on the packaging, and what resonated was most of the Isley stores had checkered floors.
Uh-huh.
So we have a checkered lid on our product, we incorporated the Swiss Boy, which appeared on a lot of their ice cream advertising back in the 60s and 70s. And we did our homework there. We have a little history on the side of the container, a brief description. And they are available in the Giant Eagles right now, and a few Shop and Saves are starting to come on board with it, too.
Oh, so you just answered my next question, which is, you got everybody excited now.
Where are you getting these?
They're all going to be headed for the intersection of the Boulevard of the Allies and Halkett Street.
Right, right, right.
With their tongues hanging out saying, where's the ice cream?
We presented this idea to the Giant Eagle, and they fell in love with the idea, and they were very cooperative in helping us relaunch the ice cream back into the greater tri-state area.
Now,
So right now it's Giant Eagle is where you can get it?
For the most part, yes, and then there's some select food lands out there, but the go-to spot would be the Giant Eagles.
Now, I read somewhere that you said that people are interested in seeing scoop shops again.
Well, yes, we may explore that, but we're looking at more than a scoop shop. We may do a modern-day Isley's store that would capture, but that's down the road if we go in that direction. But we've been getting a lot of requests for that idea too. But that's a whole nother, that's a pretty big endeavor. We're a food company right now, and that's a restaurant.
Yes,
you know, business.
A hospitality more.
Yes, yeah. Hospitality.
Yeah. So well, people are gonna be rushing out, I'm sure.
Yes.
I remember the experience of going in and there's the chip tam and it's swimming in the sauce.
Yes, yes.
With the soft bread.
Well, it's so funny. People have their different ways of making it. Like, I loved it and I would make and then I'd throw potato chips on it.
Oh, jeez.
You know, the old wise potato chips would put on there and have it. But, yeah, people have fond memories of Isley's Chip Chop Tam. And they have fond memories of the ice cream. And I read somewhere in the book that Brian wrote, it was the ham against the cow.
Well, it seems to me that On the Menu Radio, as usual, is bringing a, what should we call it, a scoop.
Yes, scoop.
That was clever. How did you think of that one, I wonder?
I can't get any credit for that. That was one of the writers came up with that.
Okay.
I wish I was that clever.
Oh. I thought I'd just come up with it.
Oh, okay. They used that in the newspaper article, too.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that was in the paper just this morning, just in your local rag this morning, wasn't it?
Yes. Both the Post-Gazette and the
Trib
ran it, and it was on the KDKA News also referenced it last night on their news.
Well, it's a big thing for all of us.
Yes.
Jim, and I thank you for doing this. As you said, you and your wife felt like you had an obligation to do it, huh?
Yes.
And you know what? You know where you should do your first scoop shop?
Where?
PNC Park.
Well, thanks for saying that, because we also have one there already.
Oh, yeah, they're already.
We had started last year. All the flavors plus Paraclaws, which is a similar to a moose track.
Oh, right, exactly.
And we also have a salted caramel truffle there.
Wow.
Well, you're ahead of me as always, Jim.
No.
I'm always thinking of things when they're too late. It's too late.
No, you all have a beautiful thing going on with the podcast.
Well, thank you, and I wish you much success. You seem to have found a lot of joy in this too, which is encouraging because we're all joyful that you're doing it. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us too, Jim.
Great. I appreciate the interest and good luck. And hopefully our paths will cross one of these days.
I hope so too. Over a rainbow scoop.
Okay. We're looking, we're exploring, we're contacting some ice cream scoop manufacturers to see if we can have them replicated. We're looking into that possibility right now.
Wow. So. All right, Jim. Thank you very much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, I don't know if I'm just imagining this or just noting it as a trend. There's been a run on maple syrup and maple flavor, maple sugar. And so we wanted to talk to CEO Mike Cobb about his company, Crown Maple Syrup. And boy, does he know a lot about maple.
Yeah, he's got a pretty sense to me like a pretty big operation. I thought it was
huge.
I thought it was kind of a craft industry. But,
there's a lot of manual, artisanal stuff.
So anyway, it's an interesting story, and we learned a few things we didn't know about
maple
syrup.
We learned a
lot about
it, yeah.
And we're sure you will too, so be sure to listen to this.
We're going to be talking to Mike Cobb, who is the CEO of Crown Maple Syrup, which is an estate artisanal syrup. But there's something I left out of that. What was it, Mike?
Exceptionally estate produced is correct.
Certified organic. 100% pure maple syrup and maple sugar, plus a whole bunch of infused or flavored maples.
Now, hold on a second. Let's point out here that Estate grown means these are all your trees,
and that's correct.
And this is your land they grow up on.
And where is that?
So we have multiple maple farms, if you will. We have 800 acres at our Crown Maple Estate in New York's Hudson Valley. We have several other maple farms around New York, and we also have more than 4,400 acres in Vermont.
Oh, wow.
We actually bring the sap from Vermont into New York, where we turn it into New York maple syrup.
Okay, so headquarters is Dutchess County, New York.
That's correct.
But
The trees are all over.
We go to where the maple is.
Well, we can tell by what you just said about the acreage that you have in Vermont. The Vermont's a big part of what you do, and it's a big part of the whole maple story, right?
That's correct.
You know, I told you just before we went on that I was a little confused because I was reading. I read a lot about food, as you know, and I read that it was so sad we had that warm snap weather this year because it got the trees started, and then we had the cold snap, and it kind of stopped the process, and there was going to be this huge shortage of maple syrup produced. Then I heard that it was an exceptional harvest or whatever you'd call that, tapping, and there was more maple syrup around than anybody knew what to do with. What is the truth, and what is the actual process involved in this tapping of maple syrup?
Right. So the key first thing to understand is whether is making maple syrup is maple farming. It's organic farming, so it's an agricultural-based product. Essentially, we take the maple sap out of the trees, which comes out like water, and then we produce it. And I'll talk about that production process. But what you're seeing in some of the notes is, you know, for example, Connecticut and Michigan, I believe, had horrible growing seasons because of the weather.
But up
in Vermont and various parts of Canada, they had very good maple seasons. So weather will vary based on elevation, based on north and south facing, west and east facing, you know, so it really comes down to the weather and what are the weather patterns within each of the sugar bushes, which is where the maple is coming from.
Sure, but weather is absolutely a factor.
Yeah, so what's key is, you know, any maple producer is really getting 30 to 40 days of production on average each year. So the days are very few and very precious. What we're looking for is essentially freezing nights, so into the mid to high 20s is good, and thawing days. So those days where it's into the high 30s and low 40s, so that essentially the sap in the tree is thawing out and it starts running up and down the xylem of the tree and activating the tree. So it's that freezing nights, thawing days, those make for the perfect harvest situations.
Now, I have a dumb question. I mean, obviously the trees produce the syrup for their own benefit, right?
Right.
What happens when we take it away from them?
Yeah, so the sap, and like I said, the maple sap, you know, in some people's heads they're like, oh, it's this thick, sticky stuff that comes out
of the tree. It's
water. It's water. It looks like water. If you have a very attuned palate, you can maybe taste a little bit of the sugar because the maple sap is coming out of the trees at roughly 2% sugar, two bricks. And what we need to do is take the maple sap to between 66 and 68.9 sugar. So really what it's involving is taking water out of the sap.
But isn't it depriving the trees?
Yeah, we're taking less than 10% of the sap out of a tree. So the tree still receives all of the water and all the nutrients that it needs to, you know, help it continue to grow and grow healthily. You know, we are, Crown Maple is a certified organic syrup, so we're taking extra care in the sugar bush for the sustainability of the trees. Something people are, you know, shocked to hear is a tree has to be at least 40 years old before we can tap it.
Really? Oh, my
goodness. So it has to be 9 inches in diameter before we can put a tap in it.
So you still do that thing where you put the tap in and a bucket over it?
Some places do that. We're a state of the art. We're employing proprietary technology that no one else has in
the maple industry. So that means you can't tell us about it.
most maple producers are doing, you know, what we do out in the sugar bush is we go out and we tap the tree. We drill a hole in it. We put a food grade plastic tap into it and attach a tube. This tubing is all connected into our network, and it's all operated under vacuum. So we have a little suction pressure that's just helping the trees pull the sap out of the trees so that we can collect it.
And
like I said, we're taking less than 10% of the sap.
But the sap's coming all the way from the roots, right?
Yeah. So as the tree gets excited with the weather, it's pulling the sap, you know, up and down. The maples are very vascular, so it's running the sap up and down the tree's tissues, connecting it from the trunk to the branches.
But
when the trees freeze at night, all of that sap goes back into the roots and back into the ground.
But it's actually garnered from the roots, extracting the liquid from the soil.
Yeah, so we put the tap in, you know, 6 to 9 foot up in the trunk.
Okay.
So our field crew has to be able to reach it and put the tap into the trees.
Now, let's tell you a funny story here.
Tell the sycamore story.
Yeah, we met a chef in England who was, he had a rather interesting career as a chef because he learned how to cook in the Royal Air Force because he couldn't find a regular job. But during his career, he worked for the Weston family in Canada, which, as you probably know, because you're pretty close to Canada facing, is a company that makes cookies and that kind of thing on a very large scale.
Yes, indeed.
And so he worked for this guy as a private chef in Canada. So he got to know about maple syrup. Well, when he got back to England, he said, I started thinking to myself, well, we don't have maple trees in England, but we do have sycamore trees, and they're the same family as maple trees. So why not I try getting some sycamore sap?
He did.
So he did. He sent off to friends in Canada to get all the gear he needed to be able to tap the sycamore trees, and he got the sap, and he worked on it, and it tasted fairly awful.
Awful.
but we
cooked the foie gras.
We were insistent that since he had told us the story and we had broadcast it, that we actually had to try it and see if it was any good.
And it was right.
Because he told us when he was in the former, his project was underway, but he hadn't tapped any maple sycamore syrup yet. So one of the dishes I'm sure that you know, as you know, a lot of people who cook with your product is duck or goose foie gras, served with
Absolutely.
A concentration of maple syrup.
Yeah.
So he did the same thing for us, made of sycamore syrup, and it's a good job that the foie gras was good.
Yeah.
Maple
is it's an amazing ingredient. It's one of the most versatile ingredients that are in the kitchen, because you can use it for breakfast foods. But you can use it for cocktail mixology. You can use it for simple topping of desserts. You can use it to sweeten with antioxidant benefits and low glycemic into coffee and tea. And maple is one of the most flavorful sweeteners you can have. So adding it into your coffee brings in this additional layers of flavors that just elevates the entire, you know, experience around coffee. You can use it as a glaze, as a dressing, as a marinade. We have a new product called Applewood Smoked.
Yes.
So we literally take our dark syrup and we put it in a smoker at low temperatures using Applewood Smoked, and it infuses all the flavor of that smoke. We pour that over our chicken and waffles here at the Crown Maple Estate, and it's out of this world. We're making a smoky Manhattan, replacing simple syrup and using the Applewood Smoked in a cocktail, and it just changes the complexity and the interest level. So it's really a fascinating ingredient in the kitchen.
Now, let's go over one more thing, too, because I noticed in your catalog you have things nominated by color. And does that mean the darker the better?
Between Canada and the U.S., it's really the only places that are making maple syrup in the world. Based on the availability of maple trees and the weather patterns, which is critical. We've all agreed that there are essentially four grades or four colors of syrup. and they are officially dictated by light transference. So we have golden, which is the lightest and most golden color. Then we have amber. Then we have dark. And then we have very dark. Now, the flavor ranges carry along with there as well. So golden is very light and buttery. Amber has a nice rich taste. Dark is getting a nice robust taste. And the very dark is the most pronounced maple that you can have, and it has a very strong taste. Now, these are not, you know, dictated by something that we Crown Maple do or the industry does. It's just a fact of nature. So we produce it, and we take what nature gives us, and if she decides to give us amber, we make amber. The maple sap comes out of the trees as mostly sucrose, and as the season changes, those sugars start to change a little bit to glucose and fructose, and those caramelize differently and have different flavors, and they become darker. So traditionally, later in the season, you'll get dark and very dark maple syrups.
And they're significantly more expensive than the golden?
Well, it all depends. Some said golden is very rare and get less of it. We at Crown Maple, we price all of ours golden, amber, dark, very dark, all at the same level.
Oh, okay. So that's,
They really do. Once you get into maple syrup, it's like, oh, I can use the lighter syrup for this application in my green tea, for example, and I want the darker, very dark, and a robust espresso coffee because they impart differences. You can have one in a flan, a very nice light caramel sauce, and a different one in a roasted butternut squash, for example.
Now, you referenced your bourbon maple syrup, and you have other infusions, which is a very distinguishing factor about your company. Like, tell us about some of the vanilla syrup.
Yeah, indeed. So we really look at, you know, breakfast is a given. We look at maple as it's this very exciting ingredient that allows us to do a lot of different things with it. Maple is also very porous, so we have a bourbon barrel-aged maple syrup. It's the fastest-growing national maple syrup on the market. And essentially, we take our dark syrup, and we age it in a barrel, and it infuses the flavors of bourbon and the vanilla and the smokiness and the oakiness from the oak. And it creates this product that is, it's really from a different world. The flavors that come in there, like, I use it to pour over just a simple yogurt with some nuts and some granola.
Sounds great.
The flavors of the bourbon, it's like changes that, you know, eating occasion to fit my mood. We also have a Madagascar vanilla infused product where we're taking a Madagascar vanilla bean, we're splitting it, and we're infusing it in the bottle, and it's aging in the bottle, and it has this nice, light, you know, floral vanilla notes that gives us just a little bigger touch of elegance and flavor that goes very nicely across a broad range of
foods.
Well,
hold your breath because vanilla is in trouble. There's
a
shortage.
We definitely know it.
Yeah.
But you have the beans are actually in the bottle.
They are. We also have a cinnamon infused maple syrup. Where we drop a cinnamon stick into the bottle, and once again we infuse it in the bottle, and it brings those flavor notes. You can smell it, you can taste it on the palate, and it just brings a different level of sophistication to where you want it. So very nice in coffee and tea, fantastic on desserts, lovely on fruits, depending on which ones you're mixing in.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Anne's pointed out she's looking at your catalog. You also make a hot sauce.
Crown Maple Horseshoe Hot Sauce. That's unusual.
So that's it's a maple cayenne hot sauce.
Wow.
So we worked with our good friends who are based in the Hudson Valley, Horseshoe Brands Hot Sauce. It's a very artisanal product, and essentially we're taking maple syrup and blending that with hot red cayenne pepper and a rich smoky chipotle to create this intense entrancing hot sauce.
You're making it all sound so enticing. You're really a good spokesperson.
Here's the only.
We're so passionate about maple, and
we really
believe that maple can be used for anything. There's really no need to go to high fructose corn syrup or corn syrup. You know, we cringe a little bit when we see products made with
that.
Because
I hate that stuff, yeah.
Maple it's organic, it's sustainable, it's paleo, it's kosher, it's all natural, it's sustainable. It's like there's so many, you know, it fits into every health trend out there, has antioxidant benefits, it's low glycemic, and it's pure from nature. It's an agricultural product. So you get all this flavor and sweet. And these added benefits, there's really no reason to use anything but maple.
Now, hold on a second. There's one thing we talked about before it came on the air. We have to mention it before
bourbon.
We go. and that is not just putting it in a bourbon barrel, but actually putting some of your golden or whatever it is into a real bourbon or a real whiskey product, and you're working on that.
Indeed. We're working with some partners of ours from Black Dirt Distillery. Once again, they're based here in New York's Hudson Valley. The Hudson Valley, you know, it's 90 to 120 minutes north of New York City. It's a magical place. The craft beverage scene and the food scene and the tourism is just exploding because, you know, it's so close to New York City. But it's such a different world to get out and, you know, experience both nature and fantastic products. So Black Dirt Distillery, is close to us, and we partnered with them over a year ago, and we're getting ready to launch a Black Dirt Crown Maple Bourbon. It's going to be more than a three-year-old. The maple syrup has been aging in the barrels for more than a year. And this product, it's smooth, it's inviting, you know, it's great, neat, mixes into cocktails, fantastic. It's going to be a very exciting product.
Yeah, well, make sure Peter gets one of those.
Beginning of the year, we did a partnership with Angry Orchard.
Oh, sure.
We've interviewed Angry Orchard.
Those guys are good.
Their cidery is based here in Hudson Valley
as well.
Well,
it was just bought out by somebody big, right?
Yeah, Boston Beer Group owns them.
Okay.
But they still have their cidery here, and their master cider maker, you know, they have a wooden sleeper where they put their hard cider into a bourbon barrel, and they age it again. So they added our maple syrup to that and created a maple wooden sleeper.
Wow.
And this product was Grand Marnier-ish. You know, digestive kind of end of dinner when you're hanging with family and friends, and you just need a little touch of something at the end of a great meal.
Hey, Bob, do you have any hobbies?
Yeah, he has a hobby.
Let me tell you about one more that is going on. So we've talked about some alcohol. Let me talk about Suniva Super Coffee.
Wow.
It's a cold press coffee with a protein enhancement. They're using crown maple to give an antioxidant boost as well as some light sweetener. And this product is very exciting. It's probably a year-old company. You're going to see more and more of them. Three brothers grew up in the Hudson Valley. They created this, organic coffee and healthy fats from coconut oil, grass-fed protein, and crown maple. To give it an all-natural sweetness in there.
Well, I'm hoping there's some black dirt in my future.
we need from him before he goes is we need for him to mention that you can have tours of the estate.
Yeah, he mentioned that earlier on.
Oh, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely, you know, our website has hundreds of recipes.
Yeah, I wanted you to give us your website so that people could look it up.
Definitely. It's www.crownmaple.com. So our brand is Crown Maple, and the website crownmaple.com. And our Crown Maple Estate is where we do our maple production. You can walk among the forest where we're pulling the sap out of the trees. You can look at the beautiful overlook out into the Hudson Valleys. You can take a maple production tour to learn all about the production, the technology. We show it to you. We explain it to our guests so they get a nice appreciation for why the quality of Crown Maple is so great, why the flavors of Crown Maple are so fantastic. And then we have a menu in a cafe where consumers can try a chicken and waffle. They can have pancakes. They can taste our vinaigrette dressing made with ground maple and balsamic. And we just showcase, you know, how maple can come to life from beverages to salads to main dishes. And it's really a great place for, you know, individuals to come, for groups to come and hang out, families, obviously, and just learn about this fantastic world of maple syrup. So crownmaple.com.
And you'll walk away with a special injection of enthusiasm.
Indeed you do.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Peter, Anne, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We were having a discussion before we came on the air about whether or not beer is a product.
Oh, it certainly is. And I said, it's certainly
a product. And not only that, but we had a special visitation in Pittsburgh just a few weeks ago when no lesser person than Tebow, who is the beer culture, he's the culture aficionado.
I don't know.
For Breckenridge Brewery from Colorado, and he brought his Soul Train to Pittsburgh as part of a series of visits to cities around the country where the break trek is taking place. Well, this may sound all like Greek to you, so why don't we just have Theo tell you all about it?
Tebow is a dangerous name in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we are now, but I'm with the other Tebow. Tebow, introduce yourself.
I am the original Tebow. Todd Tebow is my name. I am with Breckenridge Brewery. I'm our culture czar. I've been with the brewery for 22 years.
A lot of us who are beer drinkers think beer does have quite a lot of culture along with it, but they don't perhaps think of it in quite the same way as you just described it. So explain your role, your mission in life.
My mission is really to take the whole Breckenridge Brewery and Colorado culture on the road. Where folks, when we were smaller, most people would come into the brew pub and we could sit there and have a pint with them. What we're trying to do now is we go into different cities and we can basically bring us to them so we can have a beer together. We're really proud of who we are and where we're from, and we just want to talk to people and have a few beers.
Now, it's really funny because brewing and Colorado used to mean just one word, and it only had five letters.
It did, Coors, which didn't even make it here to Pennsylvania until, I believe, the early 80s.
Well, we were rapping about this earlier on because when Gerald Ford became president, people found out that he liked Coors, just like Paul Newman liked Coors, so Paul Newman made Coors more popular. But you could get bootleg Coors in Pennsylvania, but Pete Coors wouldn't ship here. And you know the story of that.
I do know that story, and yeah, I think it is a big part of, like you say, Gerald Ford and Paul Newman. Matter of fact, if anybody has also seen the movie Smokey and the Bandit, that whole movie was based on bootlegging Coors beer. I think, I don't remember where they ended up, but it was somewhere in the South. But at the end of the movie, as they opened up the back of the trailer, it was full of Coors beer.
Give us a history on craft beers in Colorado, and by all means mention Breckenridge along the way, just so people have a context for what's been happening in the 22 years you've been with Breckenridge.
I'm really proud to be part of the whole Colorado craft beer culture. Breckenridge Brewery, we were the third craft brewer in the state of Colorado. And now I think we hover right around 360 craft breweries. I'm proud of a friend of mine, Adam Avery, has always said, I not only promote and respect Colorado craft beer, but Adam said that Tebow carries the Colorado craft beer flag higher than just about anybody knows. So yes, not only proud of Colorado, but certainly our brewery, and I think we've done some pretty cool things. I'm not saying that we're the only place that can brew beer, but I think the diversity you'll find in Colorado is pretty spectacular.
Is that just because Coloradans like craft beer, or is there something special in the air? I mean, I don't think you grow hops in Colorado. I don't necessarily think you grow the grain that goes into the beer in Colorado. So, what is it that makes it so?
That's kind of a tricky question, but I think it's more of a lifestyle question. You are correct. Certainly our water, is nice. It's kind of where water comes from, in a sense, from the melting of snow and so on and so forth. So our water is really good, but I wouldn't say that's, you know, we can get around that nowadays. It isn't the 1800s. There is a little bit of hops that have been started to grow in a bit of a banana belt, if you will, on the western slope of Colorado around Montrose and Grand Junction, way on the, like I said, the western side there over by Utah. But that's not enough to sustain the industry have. The grain that is grown in Colorado, certainly on the eastern part of Colorado, there is a lot of grain that's grown out there, but it's mostly contracted by Coors. And I'm not saying they're scooping it all up. They've been in contracts with those families for years and years and years to produce Coors. But I think it's more of the lifestyle, and where we work hard, we play hard, and you want something a little bit more worthy, a little bit more flavorful. You deserve it. Whether that be, even the food culture in Colorado is really kind of taken a whole nother level. So, and we have distilleries, craft distilleries, and all kinds of great stuff. So I think it's just, I think it's the attitude that really kind of got things. And as I've always said, I think most of us that really kind of started the whole craft beer revolution, not just in Colorado, but around the country, we're just a bunch of Bernardo hippies that are pretty much unemployable, so we had to create our own industry. And we've got a lot of hippies in Colorado.
Now, we were chatting before we began this interview, and there's one English gentleman, shall we say, who probably had an enormous amount to do with the popularity of the craft beer movement around the world. And I'll plug it again, listeners. It turns out that the other Michael Jackson was born and raised in the same town in England as I was, Huddersfield. We discovered when we met in New York City, we were exactly the same age. And you said yourself a few minutes ago, Michael had a lot to do with the development of the beer movement. What was it in particular that you think he contributed?
I think the OG, or the original Michael Jackson, certainly what he did was, I think, education and just making people aware and understanding craft beer. I know when I first started to sell craft beer, I was our very first sales rep in Colorado, or for the brewery, excuse me, and home base being Colorado. It was all about a lot of education. People, what is this craft beer, and why does my, I can't tell you how many people thought hops tasted like soap. And hops are the seasoning in beer, and through craft breweries across the United States, and certainly with the backing of Michael Jackson, we all learned that, okay, you know, hops aren't soap, and we just need to find your right flavor and all that kind of stuff. So education, I think, was a big part, and he helped educate not only Coloradoans and Americans, but the entire world.
Now, we're sitting down to dinner tonight at a relatively newly opened restaurant in the center of Pittsburgh's Market Square called City Works, and we're having a beer dinner. It's a rather classy beer dinner. Tebow, why don't you take us through what's on the menu, the beer and the food?
I would love to. So about probably 2 months ago, we knew we were coming to Pittsburgh, and I contacted the chef here, and we chit-chatted about a lot of different things. His passion certainly is high, and he understands. And so what we did was, over the internet and a few phone calls and all that kind of stuff, we paired some of our beers. Now, he did a little bit blindly through my descriptions of beers. He kind of put some courses together. And truthfully, what we're going to sit down to is, and see if we really know what we're doing. So we have a welcome beer as folks are arriving right now. They'll have our agave wheat, an unfiltered wheat with a little agave nectar to kind of sweeten up the beer. And then we'll get the whole dinner started with our avalanche, which Chef is he's paired it with a tuna dish. And then we'll move on to the second course with our mango mosaic. And I have to admit, we did a beer dinner in L.A. We did a ceviche with our mango mosaic. And it was one of the best pairings I've ever had. So Chef and I talked about that. He's doing a little bit of a twist on it, but I'm really looking forward to that one. Third course for craft beer. So we've got to throw in an IPA. This isn't a crazy one over-the-top IPA, but it's a nice middle-of-the-road IPA. And Chef is actually going to pair this with some mussels. And to pair that with an IPA, it's going to give it a little bit of a zing so it stands up nicely to the IPA. Moving on to the fourth course. Chef, by the way, wanted to do a lot of courses. So we did end up with five. five courses and six beers. So I'm sure we'll all be really happy at the end. But the fourth course I think will come out beautifully. Our oatmeal stout, it's a nice, robust beer. It's actually the very first beer we produced. So this is the beer that started Breckenridge Brewery. Like I said, oatmeal stout, and he's paired it with some short ribs, some Chipotle short ribs. So I have a feeling that could be the best pairing. And then we'll end it up with the fifth course with a chocolate pot de creme, which we're also pairing with our vanilla porter, which is almost a dessert in a glass. So hopefully we'll get through the beer dinner before about 10:30 tonight. We'll see what happens. It's going to be a good time.
Now, where are you going on your tour? Where are you going next? And what other kinds of things do you have in store? Because we're talking tonight. It's impossible for people to go to an event tomorrow, unless they go to our website and check out the link which I provided there. But you're going from Pittsburgh on to where, to where, to where?
Let's see if I remember correctly. So from here, next month we'll be in Cincinnati. The month after that, we're in August. Oh, this is going to be the trickiest one. We're in Atlanta for August. Yeah, I think today we're thinking, wow, what a sticky day today is. But woo-wee, in August in Atlanta, that could be crazy. From there, we roll into Las Vegas. October, we're in Phoenix. And then we end everything up in San Francisco. So we've got some good cities to hit. We've already been to Dallas, L.A., Orlando, Cleveland, and a few other spots. So come out and join us. Go to breckbrew.com is where you can see where that whole schedule is.
Well, it was wonderful to have the opportunity to talk to you. When we sat down and before we started wasting time chatting to each other, you said you had 20 minutes. And I think we've already trespassed beyond 20 minutes. So, Tebow, once again, welcome to Pittsburgh. Thank you for talking to us, and we wish you Godspeed on the rest of your journey.
Thank you very much. My very first time to Pittsburgh, and so far I've been here about 24 hours, and it's a beautiful city. I don't know what I expected about Pittsburgh, but holy cow, I promise I'll be back.
The only thing we're missing is those snowy Rocky Mountains in the background and the water that comes out of them.
There you go.
Tebow, once again, thank you.
Boy, this week was a busy program, huh?
Yes, indeed. And
well, we'll be back same time, same place next week. And until then, bye.
Bye-bye.